Welcome to A Bite of CS, Computer Science Education Conversations. I'm Bridget Castelluccio, and I'm joined by my co-host, Corey Rogers. This is episode one. Today, we're going to discuss cognitive load theory. It's on page 20 of Hello World's The Big Book of Computing Pedagogy with Aaron Shute. As Bridget knows, and you all will hear very soon, Aaron and I are big fans of this article and keep learning more about it. So what we want you to know is this one feels a bit heavy, but it also makes a ton of sense. The big idea is that we can use thoughtful instructional design and structure to make sure that we don't create too much cognitive load for learners. And we've all seen that, kids that get overwhelmed and then show us a variety of fun behaviors to communicate to us that they're overloaded. So you'll hear us talking about some strategies to avoid that. So Erin is our friend and colleague, and we have had the pleasure of working with her on a lot of computer science projects as part of our AEA statewide computer science team. So some of the projects that she has been a part of with us include CS Ed Week, CSPD Week, script facilitation, computer science grants, and then just her vast knowledge of different programs that she's worked with closely in her part of the state. So we always enjoy collaborating with Erin. Erin, we're glad you're here. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us and the audience a little more about you?
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. I'm super excited to do this. So I have kind of a different background when it comes to education. My background is in business teaching and special ed. So when I first started teaching, I was a middle school special ed teacher. And I did that for about 4 years before I made the transition to the high school to be high school business. And that's where my experience started with computer science. I was given the web design class and was like, okay, well, what does this mean? So we had to maintain the school website, and that was all done through HTML at the time. So we made some adjustments along the way. So I did that for another 4 years, and then I came into the role of an instructional coach and curriculum director before coming to Northwest AEA to be a best practice instructional technology coach. So yes, I have a little bit different background, but I feel like it provides me with a lot of insight into different things in my job and career and connections with different teachers. So
I guess I didn't realize you started in middle school. I was always middle school too. Oh,
yes. And I love middle school, but you love middle school for different reasons. Like it takes a special kind of person to be a middle school teacher, I think. And yeah.
I loved it. I taught my middle schoolers HTML.
Oh, yes.
The syntax on that. I don't really connect that with other options for kids block-based because the syntax on HTML. You know, middle schoolers aren't great on details.
Nope.
Typically. They're still learning all that executive functioning.
They are.
Oh, we were not in charge of the web page, though, so that was good.
Yes. So that was interesting, and it developed from there because I was like, okay, here we go. And then we took it back and did some more block-based stuff with Weebly so we could get more of the design features in there. And then we went back and we did some more HTML and Java and introduced some programming. The University of South Dakota had a robotics competition happening when I was teaching. So that was kind of the first introduction to robotics for our high school students. So we would program in C. I don't know C. So that was kind of like an independent study for kids if they wanted to do it. And that class ranged from 2 students to 10 students in our small little rural Northwest Iowa school. And that was a lot of our work that we did in the second semester of that class was just learning how to program our little bot that was provided to us. It was a parallax robot. And so then what we did is every year after that is we would go to that competition, but we would disassemble it, and it would be the requirements of the students to assemble it and learn how to program that. And the competition was that they would have to program their robot to make it through like a mouse maze, and the maze would be different every year. So they had to use the sensors and things like that to figure out, and it was as far as you could get. Then they'd mark it and time it and see if anybody could get through. So
yeah. Folks that aren't in the Midwest or in Iowa,
yes.
Like how far is South Dakota from you all in Northwest?
Oh, yes. So our office is in Sioux City. So we connect to Nebraska and South Dakota. We're the tri-state area over where I am. So for us to get to Vermilion and USD is 35 minutes, 40 minutes. So that's going to be one of our closest larger university schools in our area. Yeah.
And well, I don't realize how close everything is. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah.
And I want you to touch on with our audience too. You mentioned a smaller rural area. What's your background? So describe a little bit about where you taught, but also the districts that you serve now in your role and what that role is with CS, because a lot of time we're really wanting to focus on equity and a variety of school sizes and types. Yeah.
That's a really good question, Bridget, because I came from middle of Iowa. I was an Ankeny graduate, so large class size, fairly small diversity at the time that I graduated. And then I ended up in Northwest Iowa because my whole family had moved out here while I was in college. So my first teaching job and the one that I was with until I came to the AEA was at Kingsley Pearson. And this is a school district of right around 400, like for K through 12. Not a lot of cultural diversity, but my lens on what is diverse has changed a lot now that I serve rural districts, and the fact that we still have people in the state of Iowa that don't have reliable access to the internet and things like that, even in school districts and in businesses, was kind of eye-opening to me. So now when I see like underrepresented populations, and I being in where I'm at in Iowa now, it's about the rural districts and what do they have access to compared to our more suburban or urban districts. It was a big shift for me to go from a class of 400 to a district of 400. Very interesting, but very rewarding. And I'm very grateful for the experiences that I've had. And that has led me, my rural experience led me down a deeper path into computer science, because I was a part of the computer sciences elementary program with Kingsley. And the mentorship program that went along with that as well. And I've become a part of the rural STEM work group out of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council, just because seeing the inequities for rural schools has made me pretty passionate about making sure that we do have opportunities for all of our students, regardless of where they live. So,
yeah, for sure. Do you want to talk a tiny bit about what the Computer Sciences Elementary program is, just in case folks aren't aware of that?
Absolutely. So this was something that was started by the Governor's STEM Advisory Council and the Department of Ed. And I want to say it came out in 2017, maybe, is when it was announced, somewhere in there. And it was to highlight high poverty schools, and they were going to be given an award of $50,000 to bring computer science to their school. So this was all based off of the model of Les Hills Elementary in Sioux City, Iowa. They're a computer programming specialty school. So they wanted to take that model and spread it across the state. So originally there were six schools that were given that award, and then it expanded to, ended up being 12 schools that did the project. And all of them were given $50,000, and all of them had the opportunity and the autonomy to spend it how they needed to, because Kingsley Pearson was the smallest district that was awarded that, all the way up to like Marshalltown would have been one of the bigger ones. And they all had the opportunity to decide, did they need materials? Did they need professional development? So they came up with blueprints. That was a requirement for them to decide what their plan was and how they would bring computer science education to their elementary schools. So I was a part of that program for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
I know. It feels like a lifetime, but right. Paper, it was like 4 years.
Right.
Yeah.
It feels like a lifetime, right?
I mean, yeah. So that's a little bit of my background on how I got started and with computer science and what it looks like in my neck of the woods.
It's always fun to talk to folks because Bridget and I have the pleasure of getting to work with Erin a lot, but like I've never heard you talk about your background. So anyway, it's always great to do this and you can like formally sit down and ask people like,
hey, yeah,
what's your deal?
You come from? What do you do?
Yeah. I think too, highlighting, perhaps not Corey because she has a computer science background, but many of the people who are championing this work also come from a very diverse background, but realizing this is something really important and computer science impacts our world and our work. And we maybe never thought we would be doing this. And here we are.
Right.
And that's the same with kids.
Yep.
And teachers.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, growing their identity, helping them to know.
Yep. Well,
they can do this too.
Well, and it's those skills. Because I ended up taking, like, from the hour of code, I ended up having all of my high school students do the hour of code, regardless if they were in the web design class or not. Like, all right, let's build up some of these problem-solving, troubleshooting skills that you need anyways for all of your classes. And we ended up building that into a high school buddies program. So in my district, the elementary and high school are in the same building at Kingsley. So we had the high school students invite the elementary students into the computer lab because that was my classroom. And once a month, they would do a computer science activity together. So that's where that had kind of started. And then that's when my eyes were open to realize elementary kids don't know what a mouse is. Like, they didn't know how to use a keyboard and a mouse and all of those things. And then my high school students, not only did they get to help with that, but they got to become role models and they got to practice, like, what is it like to show patience when you're working with a kindergarten student? And yeah, and like just in kind of opening their eyes of possibilities of other careers too. Like, ooh, mate, I never thought about education, but I kind of like helping the little kids with this. So it's not about sitting behind the computer and or in the dark basement and plugging away. And yeah, so it's been nice to kind of break down those stereotypical conceptions of what computer science is and help grow skills along with the content.
So, Erin, you are here also to talk to us about the pedagogy and the article about cognitive load theory. What were some of your takeaways when reading this article or exploring the theory of cognitive load?
So this is one of my, like, educational teacher, like, mind blown, like, theories, concepts, strategies. It was like that big aha And it doesn't just apply to computer science. Like, I am so glad I have learned about this. So glad. So, like, my big focus when I got started on the computer science bandwagon, and specifically, like, when we looked at, like, our computer science is elementary stuff, it's like, we don't have any more bodies to teach computer science. Like, it has to be an integrated thing. So I was so focused on making computer science cross-curricular that, like, it has to happen at the same time. It has to happen at the same time. Which it does, but you also have to teach it separately so that you can do it together.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of that, along with that, was like the physical computing. I was like, oh, that's an easy way you can do the things cross-curricularly. Like, let's get our BBots out and do sight words and our math facts and all of those things. I'm like, I'm thinking it's an easy lift for elementary teachers to be able to do that, because you're already practicing your sight words. You're already doing those things. So let's do it in a cross-curricular format so that we can bring in some of those computational thinking things alongside of it. And it never crossed my mind that you need to teach the BBots. And like, I just thought, like, oh, magically they're gonna be able to do that. And then they're going to be able to apply it right away. And no, nope, doesn't work like that. So, like, the article goes into, like, the parts of, like, your memory and how it all works.
Yeah.
And it was, like, seriously, that duh moment for me. Like, and I don't know why, but, like, this book does an excellent job of laying out concepts in that 2-page format with application and all of that. So, like, not only did it make this conceptual cognitive load theory that you would think would be so heavy, like, bring it down to earth.
Yeah.
Like, it shows you how to apply it along the way. So, yeah, like, those were, so I highlighted a part of this, of the book, that said, the manner in which new concepts are presented, explored, and applied can lead to an unnecessary extraneous load being placed on the learner. Having to juggle too much new information or unnecessary information from multiple sources can place an increased load on the learner.
Definitely.
Yeah. Whoop, it does.
Well, and I reading it again, because I think I've read this article 5 or 6 times at this point now, I feel like I get something new out of it every time. So it's always something to come back to.
Yeah.
But it was, to me this time, it was like thinking about the intrinsic load, like, especially with the BBOT, those young learners don't know directions yet. And I think as adults, you take that for granted of like, oh, they'll be fine. But I feel like that's something Bridget and I have heard. Like, I take the BBOT out to kindergarten and first grade teachers, and they're like, oh, this is going to be great for them to learn and practice directional language that, as a middle school person, I think of at all.
Yeah.
And I think the other interesting part is, I'm sure all three of us learned this in college. We took psychology courses, right?
Like,
But I agree with you, like, between the graphics in the book and then just continuing to come back to it, and it just feels so accessible that it is really easier to, like, connect ideas to, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And then I think about, like, that application of the classroom, but then I think about, like, when I am facilitating professional development, one of our PDs that we have done for since I came to the AEA was the computer science playground, where we bring all of our materials out of the media center. And again, my big push is, think about how you can do this cross-curricularly. And I'm like, no, that's not the time and place for this. Like, yes, I need to provide examples and ideas of how you can do this, but this teachers need to figure it out too. Like, they need to play with the robot to figure out what it can do before they can apply it and think about how they can teach it to their students. And even now, I push my teachers, like, the first time you bring this to your classroom, it needs to be a play. And it has to be a play. Otherwise, not only is your classroom management going to go out the window the first time you pull these, to figure out what they do anyways.
Yeah.
So you need to allow them to have that time, because not only, like, your students are going to figure out other capabilities of that robot that you didn't even know it could do.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to be able to do that. Then come back, okay, now let's teach them what the functions of that robot are and the vocabulary and all of those other pieces. Then the last thing that we do is the cross-curricular, or the next time we bring that out, it is cross-curricular. So,
yeah.
So not only has my instructional practice in the classroom changed from this article, but my instructional practices for teacher professional development have changed, and how I coach teachers with computer science has also changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is in a big book of computing pedagogy, but this doesn't just apply to computer science. So, right. Like, I even think about myself now as a learner. Like, okay, I need to do this before I can do this because I'm putting too much load on myself. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we did this in your class, Corey, like, as a teacher, my presence can contribute to that load, or how I'm explaining can contribute to that load. So I think that's another reason why that exploration is so important, where you don't have a teacher talking about it while you're trying to look at it and play with it. And I think there's so much push, and I feel like I get this when I go into school sometimes from administrators. I think they see our physical computing devices as play, and they don't necessarily want to see play happening in their classrooms. And so that's where I see a little bit of a divide, is like, no, there is a time and a place where this has to happen in order to meet those concepts and the content that you want to be learned. This has to happen first. It's kind of that mindset shift that has to happen. And when you're a secondary teacher, you weren't told to play at secondary level. So,
yeah. And I just had that experience. I took Finch Robots into an eighth grade class. And the goal is at the end that these eighth graders are going to buddy up with some second and third graders, small, non-public school, and not done a lot of computer science. So I told the math teacher, who's also the curriculum director, hey, I'm going to bring these Finch in, and we're going to use the icon-based, so the very beginning leveling coding, and they're gonna explore and play, but we also saw creativity come out of it. And so when you think about engaging students, like, there was a group of students who did with the Finch, they created their own song and light show and movement dance. And, just that creativity. And then you talk about those problem solving and collaboration. And he's like, well, what about this? I'm like, nope, that's all we're doing today. I'm coming back in a couple of days, and then we'll talk vocabulary and maybe think about how they're going to help their second and third graders explore and create and play.
Yep.
And then keep building out.
So I think you think about the purpose, like, going back to, what is the purpose of your lesson? What is the purpose of your objectives? Whatever it is.
That's just good teaching, right?
Right. Right. And this is good teaching. This is not computer science specific.
And chunking it down. And
yes.
Yeah. Like, we wouldn't throw, a computer and say, hey, open up Word doc and type out a 15-page paper, and they've never even seen the keywords and all the stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I also appreciate that. I think you've touched on it too, Erin. It's about the instructional design. So we as educators really need to be thinking proactively in our planning, that instructional design component, and then also being aware of, because we'll all do it, even though we know the theory, we'll overload that cognitive level. And then you have to know in the moment, oh, whoops.
Yep.
How can I bring it back, or how can I just pivot?
That is such a huge point, because even if you can't avoid the load, because sometimes that happens, but being able to reflect and be cognizant of that, to be able the next time, or like transition your lesson for the next day or whatever it may be, to try and reduce that load that was put on yesterday. So, but Bridget, that was a part of my notes too, is this so much goes back to lesson design and UDL and all of those components of designing a good lesson. To do your best to not overload.
But I think it, like, what it's making me think about also is they talk a lot about like knowing prerequisite knowledge for your kids. And so I think what's going to be really interesting, at least in Iowa, because our districts have these K-12 computer science implementation plans, and at least in our southeast corner of Iowa, we're seeing lots more computer science and robot experiences in the elementary. But I think what's going to happen, and part of what our work will probably be with teachers, is coaching them, because those eighth graders right now that have experience based in 3 or 4 years, they may be to a point where they're using block-based programming like Scratch or Blockly that have words, and or getting to text-based like a JavaScript or a Python. So I think that's the other thing, like you're saying, where I keep trying to go back to, like, I need to know this educator's background knowledge before I can engage them, because I don't want to push their cognitive load, but I also don't want to make assumptions that they know or don't know something. So I think for teachers, and then folks like us that are supporting teachers, like figuring out how to gather that information and then like slowly dish it out, right? What's the serving you can handle?
Well, you make a huge point, because none of us got pre-service computer science education along the way.
Except Corey.
Like, you were trained to be a computer science teacher.
Yes. Yeah. The rest of us.
Right.
I was an hour of code once a year. Woo!
You can't assume what that foundational knowledge is for everybody. Like, you really have to investigate. And some people are more willing to say what it is, and others are not.
Well, and and I think the other thing that I know I've seen Bridget do a really nice job of, and I'm sure you have too, Erin, but like helping teachers to use robots that can kind of like go across that progression of languages. So like, we really love the Finch for a variety of reasons, but the fact that in a middle school classroom, because that's where I would have been, if I had kids that had never programmed before, they could use the icon based, I can never remember the names of them, so I won't try.
Finch blocks.
Thank you, the Finch blocks. And then if I have kids that have been with me and have been doing some code.org or Scratch or whatever, they can use the Bird block.
Bird block.
Yeah. Apple. Good job.
Yep. Yeah.
Snap.
Blocks.
But or then I can make code.
Yep.
They could use make code. Yep. And then they could flip the switch. Is it Python or JavaScript in the
Python?
Yep.
Python. But so I think that's the other piece too, is like, I think some of these tools allow us to honor kids' prerequisite knowledge, but also not overload their cognitive load, because it makes it easier for you as an instructor to pivot without having to do a lot of extra prep work, when we can choose those tools that are a little more versatile and then differentiate for the kids that way as well.
Absolutely, because they're comfortable. Like, if you bring out a Finch, like, oh yeah, but now we're going to use the Finch in this way. So that alone reduces that cognitive load, because they already know some of the capabilities of love that thought. Yeah.
It's interesting. I guess I'm curious, Erin, because Bridget and I have talked a lot about this, like encouraging districts when they're making purchases to be really intentional about picking devices that really are like low floor, high ceiling, like a Finch.
Yeah.
Like preschool really could use that with an app up to CSA, right? Kids that are in CSA. But what I hear, I won't speak for Bridget, is I have teachers that are like, yeah, but they get bored of that robot. Like, we need something novel. I'm curious if you're hearing that and how you handle that, because I feel like that's connected to cognitive load.
Yeah, I have not heard that. Like, I hear that, like, with B-bots. Like, yep. And that was, like, the first thing. That was, like, most of our first introduction to a physical computing device is a B-bot. So I hear that with that, but not with those ones that we're seeing the multiple modalities of it. But also, like, on my side of the state, we still have a lot of schools that have never seen one.
Anything, not even a B-bot.
We've gone to schools this year where that is the first thing that they have ever seen in terms of computer science is a B-bot. And it's happening in 2023. So, and that's where I think there are some differences across the state. And I don't want to make any generalities or anything like that. But I do think Northwest Iowa is a little behind what we see the other parts of the state. And so I feel like in our role now, it's they want to be where everybody else is. And it's like, and that's another part of cognitive load. We can't go from 0 to 100. Like, we've got to take the steps to get there, and we'll get you there. So I think it's because our side of the state and some of the districts that we work with have never seen those types of robotics before. They don't even know they exist. So we don't see the comments of, we want something new, something flashy, that sort of thing. Yep.
Yeah. It's a hard sell. I do try to bring out cognitive load. Like, I hear what you're saying. You want the kids excited and engaged, but like, at least when I read this article and some of the links that are here as references, like, that's my understanding as well, is like, thinking about that cognitive load, because then we can engage kids in different types of problem solving or like community-based projects to use that robot. So like, ramping up what's the content and the skills versus using the cognitive load on a new device.
Yep. And when I heard you just say the community component of that, like, I've been really intentional when I've gone in and used some devices to ask students to think about solving a problem for their community with it, so that they can see it as a problem solver and not a toy and all of that. So, and it was as simple as, what if our town has a snowstorm? One of our very rural towns has a snowstorm and can't get out. How could this bot, what could you do with this bot to help bring relief to your town? And they came up with some great ideas. So I think it helps expand their thought, that creativity piece that we talked about before, problem solving skills in general. It just provides opportunity.
Well, and you're also getting into kind of, we've talked a lot about in our work together, making those experiences authentic, and how do they tie with kids' future and future careers? So, you know, even though the bot may be the same, the conversations, the discussions, I did that with the Finch robot and compared it to like, okay, what about like the Mars rover? You know, like, that's, they had to have grids to figure out the pathways or, you know, and I think you can engage students with those higher order thinking skills, and but the load of the device is now not a factor.
Right.
I'm looking at in the article, there's, I think, a really nice grid of like, what is the effect, but then what are implications for educators?
Yep.
One that stands out to me that I did a ton, but I don't see when I'm out in classroom, so I'm just curious with your experience, Erin, is providing the kids with a programming cheat sheet or a reference guide. Because I feel like I spent a lot of instructional time doing that for kids to say, like, here's what this line of code is going to start with, or here's how you format a function, or here's what the blue blocks or motion blocks or whatever it is.
Yep. I don't like, but I made from that table or that spot in this book, like I highlighted a whole bunch of those implications from computing for, what is it? Implications for computing educators. Mm-hmm. And these are just sound classroom strategies.
Yeah. Hit us. Just hit us with some. What are you thinking? Yeah. What's there, Erin?
Which ones do you love?
Yes. Like, the one, like, use techniques such as pair programming. And, like, a lot of these are around modeling. Like, how do you model this for your students? And it does take me back to some of the UDL. Like, how many different ways can I do this to reach my audience of students, teachers, students, kids, whoever it is. And that cheat sheet one really stood out to me because I think of other ways that I would use that outside of computer science. And right now, I'm doing a lot with UPAR and Read and Write. And I think about, like, I would love to make a sheet of all the Read and Write tools, because I go through fast and furious. I am putting the load on when I go to talk to students about what this toolbar can do. And my hope is that they will take one or two things away that they could implement. But I'm like, if I could provide them with that cheat sheet that they, or a bookmark, that's what I love about the bookmark that we have with this book too, is it has all those concepts that all these fit under. That kind of just remind me, but that they can just keep. So then, like, oh yeah, I don't remember what this icon means. Oh, let me pull out my bookmark. So it just makes me think of, like, again, all those instructional practices that you don't think about, concept maps and diagrams and labels, and that we just, at least when I was in the classroom, like, know they existed, but there was, like, in my mind, a time and a place when I was going to use them. I never thought about them as, like, no, these are going to be options that I provide to my students, or I'm going to model for my students to help relate the concepts and the content. So, yeah, when I looked at that list, I'm like, no, there's not a lot on here that is strictly specific to computer science. It's just good instructional practices.
Yes. And I think what the book does a nice job of is giving it within the context of computer science. But like you're saying, we can transfer that. Like, worked examples in computer science always make me think of talking to the text, like in literacy. Like, I'm going to put it up and I'm going to show you how I annotate. I'm going to show you how I mark grammatical errors. I'm going to show you how I say, like, oh, this is a sentence or two that I think I need to rewrite. All those kinds of things. It's like, yeah, it's just good teaching's good teaching. And then you tweak it to make sure it fits your content. I think we're lucky enough to have that be computer stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. And even like that redundancy effect in here, it talks about using accessible language. And I think about all the vocabulary that comes with computer science, like that can be heavy on its own, is understanding that. So like, how do we break that down for our learners so that it's more accessible for them to use and process and understand the concepts that we're teaching?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're getting close to time, Erin.
After you've read the article, are there things you're still curious about or wondering about?
So it kind of went back to just what we were talking about with those strategies. Like, where can I use these strategies? Knowing that they're coming to the forefront again. It's those things that, like, we see, we start to use, one sticks, and then they kind of float away. And so how do I keep bringing those back? And this is definitely something that I'm going to, like, share with others. It's me bringing them into my practice. Like, I know this now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my duh aha educator moment. Now, what do you do about it, Erin? What do you do about it?
Well, I feel like I just heard you saying you're going to make a cheat sheet that you will share with all of us.
Exactly.
That's a bookmark.
I love the bookmark idea too.
I do too. That's a great cheat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Erin, thanks so much for joining us. Erin and I have shared a love of this article for a while now. So I'm really grateful. Yeah, I'm really grateful that we got to talk about it, because every time it comes up, it's like on Zoom, we're making
it.
Here we go.
Yep. Yes.
We don't want computer science to be one more thing, especially that elementary, if you're kind of thinking integration or authentic experiences K-12.
Yep.
So this theory isn't one more thing for an educator to think about. It's a really good thing.
It's what you do. It's what you do every day, and it's being cognizant of how you present it. That is what it is.
Yeah.
And if you want your students to learn and do well, you'll be aware of how you present that information to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is in a nutshell.
Please reach out to us at cspodcast@gwaea.org and use our hashtag BYTECS, that's BYTE, on social media.
So keep the conversation going until the next Byte of CS.